Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Clay Smith. I'm the editor of Kirkus Reviews.
And I'm Megan LaBrie, the editor at large.
And today we're talking to Susan Choi, who has published novels for, you know, a number of years now. But her previous one, My Education, was published in 2013. So, you know, 6 years. And man, she is coming back and punching it. Right, Megan?
Yeah, she's got new tricks.
Yeah. And they're great. Well, so her latest novel set, or at least, you know, a lot of it is set in the early 80s at a performing arts high school, you know, kind of a hothouse, intense environment for teens who have to apply to get into the school in an unnamed city in the South. And there is a sort of magisterial, even kind of dictatorial teacher who seems to control their, you know, educational and social lives, right?
Right. And this book, you know, it captures that time in such an electric way, but then goes on to really examine the repercussions and reverberations of these events that happened in the character's teen years.
Yeah. So there's two teens, a boy and a girl, who are just like in passionate love with each other. And that, unfortunately, falls apart. It's not giving too much away to reveal that.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. And then what would you say about two-thirds, or at least in the second section of the book, this, the omniscient narrator whose story you were reading, we have a new narrator. And Megan and I won't say too much about that, but it is a shocker and a pleasant shocker. It throws you for a loop, and you get even more engaged with the novel, or at least I did.
I did too, and I'm so excited to have Susan on our podcast.
Yeah. Well, let's call her up and see what she has to say about all this.
Let's do it.
So tell us a little bit about how the idea for this novel came about, because someone else at Kirkus had interviewed you for our print magazine, and
right.
You know, it sort of seems like maybe you had been working on this just not even thinking really that it might be published. It might have been a short story. And all of a sudden you sort of realized you had a novel, I guess. So tell us a little bit about the process for this one and how the idea came to you.
Sure. I mean, that's a little abbreviated. So I was working on a different project that remains in an incomplete state. I've been working on it pretty, I guess, seriously is the best way to put it. I mean, I conceived of it as my project. You know, I filled out applications for residencies describing it. I hoped for fellowships on the basis of it. It was the thing that was preoccupying me primarily. And it was a project that just was complicated. It remains complicated. It involves research and all sorts of questions of just what kind of a project is it. I just kept running into, you know, stumbling blocks with it, obstacles where I just didn't want to deal with it at all for a long time. And in those moments, which sometimes lasted for months, I, needing to feel like I was being productive, would go work on other things. And, you know, sometimes those other things might be, you know, paid work that I could bury myself in and that would allow me to feel like I was being productive. You know, I teach and I love teaching. And, you know, sometimes that other thing would be, you know, some short thing that someone had asked me to write. And sometimes it would just be, you know, one of like a number of kind of slush files, as I think of them, that are just always kind of living on my hard drive. And they represent things that either I've abandoned, actively abandoned, as in like decided no more, but I can't really bring myself to get rid of them, or, you know, things that I never really knew what they were in the first place. And, mm-hmm. And this was one of those. It was just one of those things that, when I first started writing, the words that would end up being the opening of this book, I, you know, I was sitting one day in my local library hoping to have what would feel like a productive day. And I thought, oh, it'd be so great to write a short story, something that, you know, I could, something that I could actually complete and, and show people. And, I'd been reading a lot of Muriel Spark. I talk about Muriel Spark all the time because I find her very, I find her delightful and galvanizing, and the, the brevity and wit and, sharpness of her work is always kind of a, both a delight and an inspiration to me. And I thought, oh, I wish I could just like channel Muriel Spark and write something short and tart and maybe a little mean and whatever it's going to be, it's not going to sprawl. It's certainly not going to be a novel. So I started writing that scene that opens the book, Neither Can Drive. And, you know, as I said on the panel the other day, that sentence, Neither Can Drive, felt to me like a very sort of Spark-esque, compact situation. You know, two young lovers, neither of whom has a license, trying to get together, you know, short story territory. And then it just didn't resolve into a short story. And so I had to abandon it in turn and return to what I was really trying to finish at that time. And then it lingered, you know, it lingered like so many of those slush files. It just stayed in my hard drive. And every once in a while, for whatever reason, I'd go back to it and add to it. Having given up on it being a story, I spent a little time thinking it would be a novella. That dream was, you know, put to rest when my agent read it and said, well, you know, this is too long to be a story and it's too short to be anything else. I don't know what it is. you know, come back to me when you've figured that out. And so that was, you know, another several years of it just kind of languishing until it did kind of, in those accumulations, it turned a corner. And, and when it finally did turn that corner, that was actually a moment of recognizing it for being a thing, you know, a thing that might actually come to an end. And that, that was at that point going to be a book.
Yeah. And it does have quite an end. So you got there.
Yeah, I got there. I got there finally. Yeah.
It's so interesting to me. And I have what I'm afraid will turn into a long preamble to my question, but I'm going to try and cut it down. So there's there's this love story between the characters Sarah and David. They're 15 years old. This is the first section of the book. They're students at the Citywide Academy for the Performing Arts, or CAPA as it's known. And they are theater arts students. And in acting class, they perform these trust exercises, they're called, at the behest of their sharply charismatic, openly gay, circa 1982 teacher, Mr. Kingsley. And you write early on in the book, quote, of the trust exercises, there were seemingly infinite variations. Some involved talking and resembled group therapy. Some required silence, blindfolds, falling backwards off tables or ladders and into the latticework of classmates' arms. Almost daily, they lay on their backs on the cold tile floor in what Sarah, much later in life, would be taught was called corpse pose in yoga, end quote. And I want to come back to the words much later in life if we have the time. But my first question derived from that preamble is, so all three of the sections of this book are titled Trust Exercise, and the book is entitled Trust Exercise. Why not Trust Exercises?
Because, well, that's such a good question. And I think the answer is, if it were called Trust Exercises, then all of them are equally a trust exercise. And if it's called Trust Exercise several times, then it raises the question of which one is it? Which one is the trust exercise? And I think that question, which doesn't have an obvious answer, is central to the way the book works, because I think the book does end up being about trust and who can you trust, whose story can you trust, whose account of events can you trust, whose perspective, even whose set of values can you trust? And so trust exercises, I think, as I said, would imply that all of them are equally valid, equally valid, at least as trust exercises. And trust exercise singular seems to suggest that maybe only one of them is. And that's something that you know, as with so many things in writing, really kind of raveled itself in the course of the book coming together. It wasn't part of a master. I could never plan things in advance, as well as I can like blunder into them kind of by accident. And then once I've sort of figured out what's happening, then, you know, turn back around and try to neaten it up so that it works even a little bit better. But that was an aspect of the book that emerged out of the writing and the revision. And then we were able to, you know, working with early readers and sort of just talking back and forth about the ways in which the book was working, that idea of reiterating the title. I had the title, and I was really pleased with the title. And I had the title in singular. And I already knew that the book was about this at that point, because I'd finished a draft, that the book was about this question of, to put it most plainly, who do you believe? Who do you trust? And then, you know, to completely unveil the unglamorous process of figuring these things out as my agent and I were like literally like paginating the submission. She said, are we calling these like parts 1, 2, and 3? Like, what are we doing here? And I said, oh, I don't know. I never thought of it. And then she said, because she's a wonderful reader as well as a wonderful agent, I think we should call every single part Trust Exercise, just the way the book is called Trust Exercise. And I was like, that's it. That's exactly right. And that's what we did.
That's so nice that worked out that way. It's kind of an amazing story because you don't always hear that, you know?
You mean about outside readers kind of... I mean,
look at your
really
agent being able to
that,
help
yeah.
you to that degree, you know?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, my agent was incredibly, incredibly helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, a lot of agents, and I mean, a lot of writers have, you know, really thoughtful agents who are readers, but this seems to like go above and beyond in my experience.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel really fortunate with this book, you know, just across the board that way, that, you know, the early readers who were, you know, my agent and then eventually my editor and then a couple of other very, very good friends who are not just brilliant but patient, that all of those people in their separate ways brought this book into focus in a way that, you know, I couldn't have done it alone, because the book is, you know, obviously it's different than books that I've written before, and there were a lot of periods where on the inside of it I just didn't know what I was standing. And
yeah.
Then, you know,
well, let me ask you about that, because you mentioned earlier, you know, sort of feeling your way through it and you didn't really plot it out to an intense degree, but that must also feel a little nerve wracking or tense or something. I mean, you're sort of feeling your way through it and maybe not exactly knowing where you're ending up, but is that how it felt to you?
I mean, much less so than with every other book I've ever written, in which it always felt really nerve-wracking because I never knew where it was going. But, you know, again, this book, because this book was, you know, a side project, a diversion, really, you know, from this other book that I was in agonies over and that I'm still not very happy about, because I still, you know, it's still, I'm actually looking at a big chunk of it right now that's like literally, you know, standing up 5 inches tall from the floor. It's like a big pile of paper sitting here that is still a problem. And so this book was never, until pretty late in the game, this book was never the problem. It was always just a thing that I was doing that I never had to share with anyone. And so that pressure to figure it out really didn't exist in the same way. When I couldn't figure it out, I just stopped dealing with it. And every other book that I've written, because it was the main thing I was working on, and because I thought of it that way, you know, it's both like what you're doing and how you're actually conceiving of what you're doing. It was much worse, you know, it was much worse when I was writing my education and just didn't understand what was going to happen next, or like how the overall shape was going to be, or how the voice was going to work, or, you know, the book before that. I mean, all of them, all of them were much more similar to that feeling that you've described, and and this one much less, you know, and until like very, very, very late days, when suddenly almost as a lark. It was like, huh, you know, well, what if this was the book that we tried to sell instead of the other unwieldy mess?
I find this conversation extraordinarily stimulating because I'm imagining, like, did you or could you imagine, if not quite seemingly infinite variations, then at least other variations of this novel that lead from the foundational section that centers on Sarah and David's affair? Did you try other things?
Yeah, I did. I did. I tried other things, and you know, and so those other things, like, are actually, you know, on paper, so to speak, or like sitting in a file on my hard drive. There were different endings that aren't in the book. And then there's other things that I didn't, you know, quote unquote, try, like I didn't ever actually like render them in words, but that I imagine as being parts of the universe of the book, mm-hmm. That I'm like sure of. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, there are things that I didn't actually depict, but I know that that's how they went. And, you know, that's not true of every part of the book, but that's true of some parts of the book. Mm-hmm. You know, there are other questions in the book where if you were to say, well, what happens to so-and-so after this moment, I wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. But there are things that I do know.
So, you know, Susan, I mean, this isn't the first time you've written about, I guess in the broadest sense, you know, the inequality of power between people, or even necessarily, I mean, you've also written before about relationships between teachers and students and mentors and students. And, you know, this has become a very timely topic, but this novel is set in the early 80s. I mean, is there a feeling like the rest of the world caught up to you since you've been thinking about this for a while?
Oh, I mean, I don't feel like anybody caught up to me because I'm still catching up. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I think that the reason that this book took shape over time, even though I wasn't conceiving of it as a book all that time, was that, you know, these stories have been capturing our attention for years and years and years, you know, since long before the fall of 2017, there have been, you know, there's been one high profile story after another of, you know, I mean, like for a lot of people, I mean, remember Spotlight, like that's a huge turning point in our thinking, I think, about, you know, survivors of sexual abuse or sexual misconduct of some kind, and how we think through the role that time plays in the survivor's experience, right? So, you know, this stuff has been, we've been grappling with it culturally for a long time now. Yeah. And it's not like now it's an issue. It's just that, you know, now it's coalesced as an issue in a certain way, I think, because of Me Too and because of the way in which Me Too actually like gave everybody a shorthand,
right,
to refer to this stuff. But, you know, these stories are stories that have been capturing my attention for years. Like the story in the book, the sort of, the obviously made up story about, you know, the teacher, the beloved teacher who, you know, everyone adores him, but then these, you know, once student, now adult people come forward and say, well, this happened to me. It happened to me back then, but it wasn't okay then. And it's not okay now. And now's when I'm choosing to talk to you about it. And that kind of thing has been happening in real life for, for a long time. And so, I think that every time a story like that captured the general attention, it would also capture my attention because all that while I've been struggling to think about it. I mean, my education is, as you sort of alluded to, like my last book before this one, which came out going on 6 years ago now. And so was written obviously more than 6 years ago. You know, it's tackling questions like this too, but from a really different perspective. I mean, the character in my education, Regina, who has, you know, a couple of relationships with, professor figures when she is a student. You know, her attitude is like, what's the big deal? I mean, she's protesting a little too much because it doesn't go well for her. But there's this moment in the book, if you remember, I mean, I kind of remember, like, vaguely trying to remember this moment in my own book. But there's this moment in the book where her lover is a tenured professor, and she's a graduate student on the verge of dropping out. And one of her fellow students sort of tries to suggest to her that this relationship is not built on equitable foundations. And she's really made angry by that. You know, she sort of feels like she rejects that as being a valid objection to her relationship, because in her opinion, if it feels good, just do it. You know, that's obviously not what trust exercise is looking at. Like, I find these issues really complicated. Like, I find them very difficult to sort out. And I think the process of sorting them out is one that has interested me for a long time. Sort of in tandem with everyone else trying to sort them out too.
Right.
Because what a shock to be confronted or called upon to revise your own personal mythology, you know. But when you do look back, you know, when I look back on my teen years and I think of all the things it's not even that I tolerated, that I didn't even notice were things now.
Right, absolutely.
And are now horrifying in retrospect.
I think that's an experience that, you know, all of us who are no longer at that age, that we're sharing to a greater or lesser extent. I completely agree with you. I think that we're all sort of in the process of reassessing, and our values change. You know, the shared cultural norms that we all operate within are constantly changing, hopefully evolving in a direction that's more equitable and less harmful for everyone, but, you know, not necessarily always. And, so it's true that I think we're all constantly reassessing, you know, not just our past experiences, but our past actions.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, did we act upon others in ways that were, you know, formed by sets of norms that actually we would now want to reject. And if we want to reject those norms, we're going to have to look at those actions too and think, like, that action seemed acceptable at one time, but, you know, I'm not sure if I think so anymore.
Yeah.
Exactly. And also one of the things that is portrayed beautifully is like what we tend to tolerate more in the face of the great man or the exception or the artistic genius or the outlier. You know, here's this witty out gay man, you know, that he's like almost his reputation precedes him with the students. And then he is actually, you know, a lot of the language in this book is like incantatory, mesmeric, and other adjectives I'm afraid of pronouncing on air, but like repetitive without, and I'm saying that without a negative connotation. It's like he is building, he's building the foundation for their future understanding of how they will move through the world as actors and people.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Which is just, you know, sort of heightened version of what's happening to everyone at that age anyway. I mean, you know, no matter whether you're in a drama program or not, at that age, you're busily building your understanding of yourself and the world and your place in the world and trying to assemble, you know, what are my values? How am I going to make judgments? What do I choose? What do I reject? I mean, I don't think we do it consciously, you know. I certainly didn't walk around at the age of 15 going, you know, what kind of person am I? That's my job. I've got to figure that out. But it is actually our job. I mean, that's sort of what, you know, I mean, our bodies tell us to do that. You know, we transform from children into adults just biologically. And like, along with that process comes all of this other, you know, complicated work of like defining ourselves in contrast to, you know, the context that we've called home that entire time, separating from our parents and becoming more individual. And, you know, and so I think that whatever influence you encounter at that age ends up being enormously influential. And if it's an influence that's actually trying to be influential, you know, it's going to be all the more successful probably.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, did you attend a performing arts high school?
I did. I attended a performing arts high school in Houston, mm-hmm. not the school in the book. Okay. And a school at which I was, you know, for the most part, a really happy dork. Yeah. And, you know, joyfully learning skills that to this day stay, you know, because that's such an influential period of time. Like, the things that I learned to do at that age that I haven't forgotten how to do, it's just funny because I think, like, wow, what if I'd been, you know, learning Mandarin Chinese at that age instead of learning how to, you know, transform a hat into a fantastic hat with a glue gun and feathers, you know, maybe I'd be in the CIA right now, but, you know, I had a great time at that school and at the same time, I think that experience was really pivotal in my thinking about, you know, what that period of life means to us in general and what mm-hmm. it could mean in particular to theater students.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for your time, Susan. The novel is Trust Exercise, and it's out now, and we've been talking to Susan Choi.
It was so much fun to talk about it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you for helping me sort it all out.
Yeah.
It's great talking to you both.
It was such a pleasure.
So, Megan, the difficult thing about this book is that we can't really reveal too much to our listeners about what happens after the first section of this book and how it kind of twists and it's a shock surprise.
That's true, Clay, but as I've seen in the news, that didn't stop other critics from ruining it.
Well,
which actually made me mad. And full disclosure, in the middle of reading this book, I got so excited about it because it is such a unique and gorgeously written book and a great reading experience. I was so excited. I made the mistake, rookie mistake, of, you know, reading some criticism as I went. Mm-hmm. And I had some spoilers in there, some pretty intense late in book spoilers that made me go tisk tisk.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, our listeners can go research the surprise on their own. We're not going to tell them. And better yet, just read the book. It's really
just read the book.
Well, after the break, why don't we call up our editors and see what other books they have to recommend this week.
Let's do it.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
All right, we've got our editors on the line, or at least half of our editors. We apologize that Vicki Smith, our children's editor, and Laura Simeon, our young adult book editor, are both on vacation this week. But we've got Eric Liebetrau, who covers nonfiction for us, and Laurie Muchnick is our fiction editor. So, Eric, tell us what we should be reading in nonfiction.
I got a fairly lighthearted book about our current president. It's called Commander and Cheat, How Golf Explains Trump, and it's by Rick Riley, the acclaimed sports writer, who was a columnist for Sports Illustrated for many years. And actually way back in the day, he's actually known Trump for about 30 years. And Trump once called him my favorite writer. But probably not after this book, because this is all about, how every aspect of Trump's famed golf game is based on cheating. Every single, he cheats on his scores and, you know, his putts, the lies of his shots, everything. Riley kind of uses this as a lens through which to look at how, you know, he constantly lies in our public discourse as well. And it's, you know, I know people are probably pretty weary of these Trump books, but this one is really easy read. It's pretty funny, like most of Rick Riley's books. And I think, it's worth a read. And he writes at the end, he says, you can think Trump has made America great again. You can think he has made America hate again, but there's one thing I know, he's made golf terrible again.
I'd like to hear a panel or something with Rick Reilly getting together with Tony Schwartz, the guy who ghost wrote The Art of the Deal and has a lot of things to say about Donald Trump.
That would be a great conversation. Yeah. I would for that.
Yeah, all festival directors take note. I would go.
So did you all see that, you know, we're recording this pretty soon after Julian Assange was arrested by the police in the UK because Ecuador stopped protecting him in their embassy. And during the presidential campaign, Trump kept saying how much he loved WikiLeaks. And when they asked him the day that they arrested Julian Assange what he thought about WikiLeaks, he said, I don't know anything about that. I don't have any thoughts about that. And then a reporter asked him about who did he think was going to win at the Masters and how did the lineup look on the Masters. And he went on and on and on. It was just so sad because, you know, we've got this president who can't or won't comment on, you know, issues of national security and deep importance, but yet he'll go on and on about golf.
That's because he's watching golf.
Yeah.
All day.
So did he call it? Did he say Tiger was going to win?
No, he did not.
No. Of course not.
Yeah. Oh, shaking it off, we'll turn to fiction. Lori, what's your choice for us this week?
I've got a book called Women Talking, the opposite, I guess, of the Trump books, by a Canadian writer named Miriam Taves. I'm going to spell her last name for you in case you want to look for this book, because it's T-O-E-W-S, which apparently is pronounced Taves. She is from an interesting background. She grew up in a fundamentalist Mennonite community in Canada, which has appeared in some of her other earlier books, which aren't as well known here. She published a book a few years ago called All My Puny Sorrows, which was published by McSweeney's, and it was a great book. We gave it a great review. I really enjoyed it myself. So this book has been picked up by Bloomsbury, a bigger, more mainstream publisher, and I'm hoping she'll get some more attention. So this book is based on a true story. There's a Mennonite colony in Bolivia, and from 2005 to 2009, women in this colony were waking up in the morning, you know, bloody and in pain and feeling like they had been raped. But everyone thought it was like a mass hysteria, or it was known as the ghost rapes. They were maybe being raped by Satan to, you know, punish them for their sins. And then, of course, eventually two men were caught going in the window of one of these women's houses. And it turned out that eight men had been spraying some kind of animal anesthesia into the houses, knocking everybody out, and then raping the women. So this book is based on that real case. And what it is just eight women from the community sitting, I think, in a hayloft, talking about what they should do. Should they leave? Should they stay and fight? The men of the community have basically ordered them to forgive their rapists. Otherwise, they'll be excommunicated. And you know, even worse than that, they won't get into heaven, they're being told. So they're just talking, and it's almost like a Socratic seminar, like the Symposium of Plato or something. They're talking about their faith and theology and philosophy, and it sounds maybe a little dry, but it's just fascinating and so well written, and you know, it's got a cover of women in the jacket of the book has women in like black bonnets. And I think it's meant to evoke a Margaret Atwood, Handmaid's Tale kind of thing. And it does in a way, even though it's a totally different story. But if you like that, you'll probably like this. And it really is a fascinating book.
It's great. I loved All My Puny Sorrows. So I'm excited this one. And well, you took the words out of my mouth. I was going to mention Handmaid's Tale. It seems like this would be tailor-made for fans of that book.
Yeah, I was reading it in a galley form, an early copy, and I just, when I got to the office today, I had the hardcover copy, and I see there is actually a blurb from Margaret Atwood on the cover of the book, right across the top. So I guess she endorses it also.
Nice. Well, thank you all. Those are some great choices. We hope you all join us next week. We're going to be talking to another novelist, Christian Kiefer. And we have liked his novels over the years. His newest one is titled Phantoms, and it is about two families that are trying to make peace with their past and the wars that they were involved in. Our reviewer says it will break your heart, and in the breaking, fill you with bittersweet but luminous joy. So we're looking forward to talking to him, and we hope you join us. Until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.